Marvellous. And the Siren News team will be around for the 5:45 news bulletin. Meanwhile, Anna, you're back with us. Would you like to find out from Dr. Finn Pollard what he's been thinking about in terms of the American political situation? Because that's why he's our go-to person when it comes to British soul commenting on American politics, possibly looking after a revitalised American studies programme in the near future, one hears.
It is, yes, pending.
All the best things are. Finn, for the benefit of the listener who might have thought, America? What's that got to do with Lincoln? What's it got to do with the free world in general? You know, we want to find out what's happening in North Korea. What is the situation in terms of the current electoral state there, apart from electing interesting people?
Well, it was an interesting moment overnight last night. The first sort of big tests of the state of politics there since the Trump election last year, with most notably two big governor's races in Virginia and New Jersey. Mm. And both parties were, as usual, pinning their, you know, it was going to be a good test of where party strength lies.
Or was it not going to be a seek? Was it seek and you shall find?
Well, yes, that's the first. Somewhere in New Jersey has elected the first Sikh mayor, I think, in one city in New Jersey. Mm. But I think the really interesting result has been Virginia, where there was a lot of worry among Democrats in the last week that the race was really tightening. The progressive progressives on the left were complaining that the Northam, the Democratic candidate, was much too moderate. And in fact, it was a much wider margin for him over the Republican than was expected, and at the same time they made the biggest gains for Democrats in the House of Delegates since 1899. So it's giving them quite a lot of confidence that they can turn the popular or the anti-Trump mood in places like social media and protest marches into actual positive electoral results for Democrats.
The headline from The Independent: US elections winners and losers as Democrats take New Jersey and Virginia. Opposition jubilant after bad night for president and Trumpian nationalism. Jason, any thoughts from yourself?
Well, I was watching this with absolute fascination. As I was saying to Finn before we came in, the horror that would have affected somebody such as myself if the Republicans had actually made gains last night, because I think it was being held as a plebiscite on Trump's policies, and also particular with Gillespie, wasn't it, the Republican candidate. The fact that in 2006 he was explicitly castigating the Republican Party for engaging in anti-immigrant tactics in the book that he published that year, and yet in the past 2 to 3 months had started running effectively racist and certainly racialist campaigns, attack ads on Northam. If that had proved popular with the voters in Virginia, particularly after what happened in Charlottesville and elsewhere, that would have been, that on a personal level, that would have been, I have no idea anymore what is going on in American politics. It's entered a completely new phase. And just how much of a bubble that I was operating in. So on a very personal level, I was reading with avid fascination that the outcome this morning, because it did seem to draw attention to this reaction against Trump, this vote upon.
Anna, Price. Returning to yourself in Jersey as opposed to New Jersey, you see what we did there? It's a tenuous link, but it is there. As you actually revealed to us, New Jersey, of course, was named after Jersey, I believe, back in the day. Any thoughts? Is it something which concerns your good self? Is it a case of, no, I'll stay in between England and what remains of Europe?
Yeah, we've just been told at work that we need to tweet. And I just wonder how much of the general campaign in the USA is all tweet-worthy in a tweetocracy. I don't know how this works on a smaller scale. I mean, Donald Trump seems to be the father of the tweets. And do you think that public opinion is swayed by that kind of culture?
Tweet-worthy in a tweetocracy. William Blake would have been proud of that one, I suspect. But before we find sort of views from there, I mean, as the younger soul here who's been entertaining the people in Skegness for the last few months, the Donald Trump issue, is it a case of, are you concerned, you know, growing up in this world where we have Trumpian politics and so on?
A little bit, but because, obviously, from the younger generation, it can kind of get a little bit biased, I think, because if your parents are in favour of, like, Donald Trump and, you know, whatever else, they're kind of swayed a little bit more by the politics that your parents believe. Mm. So, That's my point of view from the younger generation.
So forget the 280 characters or less. Yes, they've doubled it for most users now. How exciting, you know, because you get that extra 140 characters per tweet. Donald will be beside himself on the morning.
Sad.
Exactly. That phrase of in a tweet worthy of a tweetocracy. Are we living in a tweetocracy?
Well, one of the interesting things is that if you followed sort of social media, particularly in the last week, you would have bought into the view that the Democrats might have a really bad night last night. Because on social media, the two halves of the Democratic Party were tearing themselves apart. Trump was, making the most of that in his regular tweets. But it doesn't seem to have impacted, you know, that civil war doesn't seem to have impacted on the vote. So it's odd because at the same time, it's very clear that as far as the media is concerned, particularly Trump's regular tweets drive the news cycle in the States in a big way. But one wonders how much that gets through to the rest of the, you know, to the, as it were, the man in the street or woman in the street and with what effects.
Jason?
My comment would be, with regard to Donald Trump in particular, it's very, very clear that his tweets do have an immediate effect, that he is the theocrat of the twittocracy. But in relation to that, I'd also say that actually we're experiencing the law of diminishing returns with Donald Trump at the moment. If you remember when he was first elected, for those few months, particularly up to and just after his inauguration, if Trump tweeted on a particular American business negative effects, its stock price would fall. There were a whole host of immediate effects that would come from, in those days, a mere 140 characters. But actually what's become evident over the past 6 months or so is that actually Trump is proving himself to be incredibly ineffective as a leader. You know, the major legislation that's gone through in the first 9 months of his presidency, zero, as far as anybody can tell. Interestingly, you know, he supported Luther Strange, who didn't receive the nomination during the primaries. Was it last month or the month before? He supported Gillespie, but didn't win. And actually, whilst Trump has he has the bully pit, the megahorn, which he can immediately reach an audience in a way that is remarkable amongst any world leaders. The impact and the effects of just simply shouting loudest in this particular medium are running into inevitable consequences of any medium. Just because people controlled newspapers did not automatically mean that they would get their viewpoint across. There would always be opposition. There would always be people who then would interact with different, you know, conversations with family and friends and stuff like that. So Trump controls the twittocracy. But actually, he's finding out that power is itself limited, very much. And precisely with the effects you were saying about the democratic civil war that's going on outside of the Democratic Party, nobody seems to be paying attention to this, fortunately for them, last night.
And interesting enough, Anna, just returning to your good self and tying in with a recent social media post you put up yourself, weirdest expression for going insane, he fell beside his wits, as opposed to his tweets. John Leland, would you like to share with us why you decided that was worth sharing with the world, Anna?
Well, it was a talk that I went to on cartographers, and Leland, as I call him, but apparently his name's Leland.
Nice.
Fell off his trolley, literally mentally, and became insane, and then subsequently died. And we have another map maker in Jersey who did precisely that, and he ended up in an asylum in France. And I just sort of debated whether or not this is something to do with people who study map making or cartographers. That is a hazard of the job, like hatters go bonkers, and whether or not map makers also suffer from the same plight. But it was such a twee, strange sort of way to describe, having gone mad, that I thought it was worth posting.
Of course, fine line between genius and madness. If you've actually got constituent chemicals in making hats that might mange you a little bit bonkers, etc., that's a different line entirely. And clearly we want to be politically correct when we actually make use of the B word, because obviously we're in that kind of society, which is very important to work our way through. We're not suggesting in any way, shape or form for our CIA listeners that Donald Trump has either made maps or indeed made hats in his life. But it could explain a lot. Anna, it's any questions that you'd like to put to the team about life, the universe, and so on and such like? It's over to you from Jersey.
Yes, well, if anything interesting interesting. Anything exciting happening in Lincoln right now?
Please, we've just wrapped up Future 2.0. And if you just look at events to come, Finn's got another edition of Past Prologue coming through and being piped through the system. Jason is working like a whirling dervish, coordinating the School of English and Journalism and Public Relations in just a phenomenal way. And Eva's been having knives thrown at her. I mean, you know, what?
The most exciting news we've heard this evening was the knives.
Exactly. So, yeah, I think we have to leave it there, apart from maybe briefly, Anna, ask you to go back to say why the photograph of the monument to Alan Wicker.
I was waiting for a bus to get from an antique fair back to the centre of St Helier, and I had 20 minutes to kill, so I thought I'd walk through the graveyard. And I found Alan Wicker's gravestone, which is so simple and so... It's lovely to see that because it's not pretentious. Now, if you look at someone like Mr. The chap who's got the holiday camps, is it not
Billy Butlin?
Butlin. Mm. He's got a granite poster bed on his grave in St. John's. It's the most vile and vulgar funeral monument I have ever seen in my life. Whereas Alan Wicker's is sedate and it's humble and it's simple, and I respect whoever did the monument. It embodies a very gentle man who, you know, did his bit for world knowledge. But Billy Butlin's, no, that's just...
In keeping with travel journalism. There we have it. And who would have thought that at 13 and a half minutes past 5 o'clock we'd have actually gone from Donald Trump to Alan Wicker's grave? It's a thought, you know. More on Trump, plus William Blake and the connection with Jenny Finch, our ace writer at the Tate Gallery, in the very near future, in the next few minutes. But meanwhile, Eva, last two questions, please, for Anna Lewis.
Have you had an interesting telephonic link with us today?
I certainly have. Thank you for the invite.
You're welcome. And will we be hearing again from you soon?
I'd love to come back. Thank you.
I'm not afraid to
with the name taken from a graphic narrative called The Defenders, I believe, when literally the teardrop explodes, When I Dream, Julian Cope et al. Time now to actually go live to Saltburn-on-Sea, a marvellous place because it's the home of Ace Alex Hastings series author Jenny Finch. How are you, Jenny?
I'm fine, Alex. Lovely to talk to you.
Excellent. And we have a triple triumvirate of talent in the studio. Not only do we have Eva McDonald, we may actually share the story of how she also was singing with Chico in part of the whole... The pain this girl has been through. You know, it's unbelievable. It's Chico time. It's amazing. Finn Pollard has been sharing with us the views and thoughts of the current American presidential scene. Not sure that's floated over to Saltburn, or it's a case of we just don't know what's happening, really. We also have Professor Jason Whitaker, who can finally, after having a false start a few weeks ago, for reasons which were just beyond our ken, to quote a well-known Radio Times programme of years past, which, Eva, it's all right, I wouldn't expect you to actually know what beyond our ken is, so it's a different line.
That's okay.
Jenny, would you like to share with us the tale of your connection with William Blake and the Tate Gallery?
When I left college as a young teacher, I had no intention of teaching, and I applied for a job at the Tate Gallery as a technician, and I came second, but I had spent some time making educational programs while I was at college. And the head of education then, Terry Meesham, rung me up in the middle of the summer vacation and invited me to go along and make some programs. When they came to do the Blake exhibition in 1978, William Blake and his followers,
yes,
he invited myself and a fine animator called Sheila Graber from Newcastle to come along and be part of the exhibition. He put one of us on one side of the main hall, one on the other, and we had to sit there and make our respective educational programs while the public milled past and asked questions and looked at what we were doing. And so for a week, I was a part of the William Blake exhibition.
Fantastic. Absolutely fantastic.
Yes, the 1978 period was famous for a little bit of avant-garde material as well. Would Blake have approved? You
absolutely.
Think,
I mean, the Blake would be overjoyed just to know that he's in the Tate Gallery. I mean, he wasn't actually completely neglected in his lifetime, but he was very, very much on the margins of the London art scene. So the fact that, I'm very good friends with Martin Marone, who's one of the lead curator at Tate. And the fact that Tate Britain now celebrates at its core that its three main artists are obviously Turner. Turner is the greatest artist from that period who shaped modern art, but also then Constable and William Blake. For me, that's just what Blake's position at Tate, at the heart of London, at the heart of Britain, is it never ceases to amaze me.
So you see, Jenny, 39 years ago, who would have thought that that moment that you actually thought just going to echoes now, cascades through time like some sort of wonderful metaphorical stone in a pond, etc. Blake, for yourself, Finn, William Blake, is he somebody you think, well, clearly the reason he spoke to angels was because he was looking at too many maps. Sorry, it's just a reference to earlier in the programme.
I know very little about him, actually. My main contact is through my sort of personal interest in sort of classical music and the various composers who've set some of Britain. Britain is the one I know best. There's an American, William Bolcom, who did a recent new version that I haven't had a chance to hear yet. But that's mainly how I've known him, much less through his sort of artistic side.
And in your operatic world, Eva, any William Blake that's crossed your path?
William Blake? There might have been. Back in the day, I probably did do a little bit of William Blake and stuff. Can't touch on it now. But I'm pretty sure I've passed him and gone past it in the past.
If you're interested in classical music, one of my favourite versions is actually Vaughan Williams.
Oh, Job, I do like Vaughan Williams.
Job, A Mask for Dancing is absolutely beautiful piece of music, which was actually based upon Blake's illustrations to the Book of Job. And the libretto was written by Geoffrey Keynes, the brother of William Maynard Keynes, the famous economist, who was a Blake aficionado and one of the main Blake collectors. So, and this is just an incredible piece of work from, you know, the 1950s, I think it was produced.
So there we have it. Jenny, I mean, I heard a slight sort of utterance there from yourself when Jason mentioned Job.
Yes, that's an astonishing piece of music. There's also, you can probably find it somewhere on YouTube, an avant-garde semi-jazz television programme, which was written by Adrian Mitchell,
yes,
I believe.
Yes, yes. Tiger Celebration?
Yes, it was called Glad Day, I think.
Yes,
and
yes.
It had Jonathan Pryce and Zoe Wanamaker playing Mr. and Mrs. Blake.
Yeah.
And it was a lovely work. It was absolutely delightful. And I used to show it to my students a lot to get them interested in the people around that time and the art.
See, that's what we like to feel at Midweek Drive. It just opens up a few notches of life and so on. Jenny, Finn was talking about the American... they're not presidential elections, they're just elections for governors, New Jersey. Finn, just explain exactly what we were referring to.
I suppose it's the off-year elections. So there are a couple of state governors and state houses up for election.
Now, I mean, allowing for that and allowing for the Democrat success that has taken place, any sort of views from yourself? I mean, could you, Jenny, for instance, envisage maybe, I don't know, Alex Hastings Volume 7 being set when Alex Hastings goes to America and suddenly encounters a whole range of exciting things?
In theory, yes, but I've never actually been there, and I wouldn't like to try and write something that I don't know. I know someone who was in California in the late 70s, early 80s, so that might be possible. They actually went to work with the probation service for 2 months.
Let's just set
so
the
that
scene,
would be useful.
Because just as we've sort of been identifying who William Blake happens to have been, and various other bits and pieces, I'm sure, Eva, you're keen to find out Alex Hastings' fictional character, at least bearing in mind that one person's reality can be another person's fiction, and vice versa. Would you like to explain, Jenny, for Eva, and indeed many other folk, what exactly the Alex Hastings series is all about, and why actually Roger DeBank, was Roger DeBank part of this?
Yes,
Roger thought it was the most authentic representation of English culture in the 1980s in the Southwest, get off my land, and so on, that he'd ever actually read. So, over to you.
I am knocked out by that. Thank you for telling me that. Well, Alex Hastings is a probation officer who's into her second career, so she's slightly older than most of the young officers. And she goes down to Somerset to the mystical, imaginary town of High Point, which bears absolutely no relation to Bridgewater whatsoever. And she has 5 years there as a probation officer, trying to first understand the accent, second understand the customs, and third understand why in the 80s the job she's trained for is disappearing and a new one, which is much more vindictive and not suited to her training, is being thrust upon her.
And we start off, of course, with the Drowners, Death of the Elder Man, and the whole thing continues, does it not, Jenny?
Yes, Death of the Elder Man's the first, and the Drowners, and then the Mothman and Smoke and Adders, which was completed last year.
Exactly. Fifth one in the works. We can't say anything else because obviously great things will be happening, but it's all good stuff there. Eva, would you like to put those last two? Oh, in fact, before then, Jason, have you got any questions you want to put to Jenny about life, her times, and Blake?
So many questions about Blake. Actually, I'll ask a simple one. What's your favourite Blake work?
I think possibly the Proverbs of Hell.
Fantastic.
I find them quite inspirational, and I have a complete graphic work, a book with the complete graphic works in, and those are the ones that I go back to over and over again. Innocence and Experience are nice, but the Proverbs of Hell, they've got teeth and depth.
Yes, the Marriage of Heaven and Hell is my favourite work by Blake.
Really?
Yes.
There you go. A connection over the phone.
Absolutely.
We could almost use that as one of the final two questions, really. What's your favourite William Blake poem? But still, William Coles would appreciate it, be slightly off. But let's state with those classic ones. Eva, ask them, please.
Of course. Have you had an interesting telephonic link with us today?
It's been one of the most interesting ever.
That's true. And will you be joining with us again soon?
I will be delighted if I'm invited. Thank you.
That's it. And don't forget, you can also download the podcasts of Jenny Finch's very own monthly Book of the Month podcast, which upcoming treats will include the one and only coverage of Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett and Good Omens. So it's all good. Greta Bjorn, Benny and Anna Fried, collectively known as ABBA, with Head Over Heels. You might say that's the Democratic Party at present, Finn. Tenuous link, I know, but we are the station of tenuous links. They would. Yeah, exactly. I hope so too. On our running order, we have a new singer-songwriter making her programme debut, Binky. Well, that's partially right. It's partially right insofar as we will be unveiling her latest tune for the critical ears of Eva, of Finn and Jason. Tragically, we just seem to be getting a voicemail from Binky, so clearly you're not going to get a great deal of reciprocal conversation on that scenario. I have emailed her agent to actually explain the situation. She might be out of range. She might have actually heard the awesomeness of the William Blake discussion and realised that there's no time for the trivia of Fireflies. Don't worry, Binky. We promised Tessa Snart, who's currently doing her own work placement, that we would actually give an airing to this on the midweek drive. And so are we ready for Binky and Fireflies? Is that a yes, Jason?
Yes, yes.
It's a, it's a, yeah, that's good. It's a yes. Here she comes. Astonishing. You're listening to Siren Radio. It's just coming around to 25 minutes to 6 o'clock, which means we're 10 minutes away from the Siren News. But first, Eva McDonald, what did you make of Binky and Fireflies?
It was a good song. It was upbeat. It was quite catchy. The music video was different.
But kind of more music horror to a certain extent.
Yeah.
We were genuine. I mean, hopefully no fireflies were actually harmed in the making of the music video, because we'd be most concerned for those little insects if there had been an issue from that perspective. Finn?
Well, I suppose I can repeat what the thing I immediately noticed that the in the video they were walking through in very high heels on uneven terrain.
in these sort of October November times, you're going out there. Wear some sensible shoes,
very
Binky.
Chilly.
Wear some sensible shoes. I'm presuming Binky actually was featured on the video, unless it was a stand-in double. You never know with popular music entertainers. Jason.
What could I possibly add to our discussions of sartorial choices in the wilderness and firefly maintenance by the lakeside? In both regards, it was truly an exceptional piece of work.
Yeah. And the good news, Binky, is that Tessa Snart has said that she wants to feature it on an edition of Sound and Country Vision. So who knows? You might actually join us on the midweek drive, if we can reach you via telephone, or indeed tapping the table, or postcards perhaps. Still to come on the programme this evening, we've got Andrew Cleek, who'll be talking about the For the Love of Sci-Fi event that he's scheduling for December the 2nd and 3rd in Manchester. Jason, David Hasselhoff, Dolph Lundgren and William Shatner in the same building at the same event.
Surely that will be a singularity and we'll plummet through into a black hole.
My thoughts exactly. Yeah. We'll be finding out from Andrew how he's actually coping with that in the...
So jealous.
I'm looking to set up a location report. I think we need to go there for the next phase of Telefantasy Society.
We do actually need verification that this event will take place and is not some appalling construct in a drug-addled brain of a deranged god.
Precisely. Dave Prowse sadly can't make it because he's not well.
Oh.
So it'd be otherwise you would have...
Lord! It's just get better and
exactly.
Better.
So maybe they're just holding fire on that. Paul Zollo will be talking about songwriters on songwriting and the everlasting argument, it would seem, between are lyricists or songwriters actually poets? Are they contemporary? Are they not? The debate of that. He was very excited when I mentioned the William Blake connection, so he'll be there as well. He might feel, if you're able to stick around, have one or two sort of thoughts with respect to America, as he is based in America. And indeed, our next three closing folk, Larry Nemechek from, of course, the Star Trek magazine article, Professor Trek, Dr. Trek, and so on, will be with us, as indeed will Phil Dearness. Back well again. He was poorly last week, actually, and was unable to sort of take part in all things. So good news as far as that's concerned. Eva, you will be heading off in the second part of the programme, so you won't be with us.
Yes, back through the dark, but I'll be back.
As long as you've got suitable for shoes. And,
I do.
I think we're just checking the shoes are okay, and you're not wearing a kind of 1980s ball gown a la Hammer Horror and so on.
No, but I do have work trousers on, and they're not the warmest, so...
Well, you know, clearly we haven't identified where Eva is currently to be found, but it's a store that actually originally opened in Nottingham and actually deals with chemists and kind of also has footwear in the title. I shall say no more. People can deduce the line from that, because I feel, Finn, as though we can never actually overestimate the intelligence of our listener.
I'm sure that's very true.
So Wellingtons.
Jason, all that time in magazine publishing, it's worked. Speaking of fireflies...
Self-believe that planet Earth turns.